You're listening to Fakeologist Audio Chat. To connect to our always-on and always-streaming audio chat, go to fakeologist.com/audio chat. This is a new and exciting way to communicate with fellow fakeologists from all over the world. Each day we compress and post the day's audio into a file that can be big or small. Discover new voices and ideas that talk about media fakery like you never did before. Please search for Fakeologist Audio Chat and Fakeologist Main Show on your favorite podcast app. To listen to the live stream, go to fakeologist.com/radio3. Now, on with the audio chat.
This photograph of Marcy Borders came to symbolize the collective trauma New Yorkers experienced on September 11, 2001. She was nicknamed the Dust Lady. She died 2 weeks ago of stomach cancer at the age of 42. Photographer Stan Honda, who took the picture, encountered Ms. Borders in the building next to the World Trade Center after it collapsed.
This woman walks in and completely covered in dust. You really couldn't see any features or tell what kind of clothes she had on, anything like that. It was a very eerie sight, and I had only enough time to take one picture of her, one frame.
Susan Hare barely escaped the disaster. She was working in a bank on the 68th floor of Tower 2. She remembers the moment the first plane struck.
I got in an elevator that wasn't supposed to be working and took it down to the lobby. There, I tried to get out onto the plaza, but they had blocked it off. And I found out later it was because the people were jumping out of Tower 1. I went to get out onto Greenwich, and a policewoman told me, "Don't look down, just run."
As Susan Hare ran, she merely tripped on body parts. She's still haunted by the memory. This is the first time she's found the strength to return to this spot. It took tremendous effort. Since the 9/11 attacks, she has suffered from post-traumatic stress and asthma. She's also a cancer survivor. Without public assistance, she would never have been able to pay her medical bills. But the $2.8 billion fund, supported by the James Hadroga 9/11 Health and Compensation Act, named after one of the first responders, is set to run out at the end of the year.
It's very important to me and to the fellow survivors of 9/11. The aid that we get from the Zegarra bill helps us pay our medical bills and also networks us with a whole bunch of doctors that are familiar with the 9/11 illnesses, both physical and emotional and mentally.
One of the specialists who's treated many 9/11 survivors is Dr. Michael Crane. He's concerned about what might happen if the aid program is terminated.
The interruption of that care, while no physician, to my knowledge, would abandon a patient, would eventually lead to a disruption of the services at a very critical moment. And it could be, yes, it could be a tremendous setback for many of our patients who are being treated for these critical diseases.
That's a view shared by Margaret Chin, a Democratic representative of the New York City Council. She fears that Congress, in a cost-cutting measure, could slash funding, handing responsibility to New York.
We just want Congress to know this is not a New York issue. This is a national issue, because the people that came to help to do the rescue effort, they came from almost every single state in the United States.
Susan Hare will be dependent on public health assistance for years to come. If Congress ends the funding, she and thousands of other New Yorkers will be left in the lurch.
I was in New York City. You know, I grew up in New York City. I lived there my whole life. And so by 9/11, I had moved out to here for about, let's see, 9/11, about five, I was here for about 5 years. So the night before, on 9/10, the cast of Raymond flew into New York City. We were about to do a one-week press junket because our show had just syndicated. So we were going to do all the shows, the talk shows and the interviews and whatnot. So we all flew in on American Airlines on September 10th with the cast, a couple of producers, a couple of assistants. We drove over the 59th Street Bridge. And I remember, I believe it was Aaron Champion, who's Phil Rosenthal's assistant, had never been to New York. One of them, and we saw the Twin Towers from the 59th Street Bridge. We pointed them out because they had never been there. And there they were. And the morning of 9/11, we were all scheduled to do little things, but all of us were going to be at the Rosie O'Donnell show. And as we were getting in the elevator, one of the PAs at the Rosie show was taking us up and said a plane had hit the World Trade Center. Did you hear? And we hadn't heard. And we got into the green room, and it was Peter and I there. We were waiting for the cast to come. We were there first. And we immediately turned the TV on. And there it was. One of the towers was burning. And we still thought it might have been a small plane. And the news people were speculating and whatnot. And, you know, just a horrible accident. Watching on live TV, and I saw the second plane hit the tower. Nothing kind of made sense. And I remember exactly what I said. And it sounds a little contrived now, but the words, I don't even know if it was like subconscious. But I, when the plane went in and Peter was kind of off to the side, I just said, everything's different. And I didn't even know what that meant at that time, but, you know, it kind of meant what it is. I mean, it was true. And then, of course, it became clear this was an attack, and everything was, you know, the Rosie show was canceled. The cast never came, and we went back from there. We went back to the hotel to meet everybody. And we all were in one person's room. I don't remember exactly which person's room it was. And we were just watching on, we had the TVs on, we're watching, and we were dumbfounded. We were calling, my wife and kids were back home. And then we sat there, and we watched the television, and until eventually the first tower fell. And I remember thinking, because people were frightened, there was a couple of girls that had never been to New York, a couple of the women who had never been to New York were upset and were breaking down a little, and then the building fell. And I think it was then where I started looking at the TV. It's actually when the second, you know, then it was just chaos and watching, and then the second building fell, and I remember sitting there thinking, I almost had a panic attack because I was thinking, this can't be real. This must be a dream, but I feel so awake, and that doesn't make sense, watching and listening. And then the rumors came that the rumors that the Empire State Building or the George Washington Bridge was loaded. And one of the young assistants actually broke down and started crying, and we decided, let's get out of the hotel room. This is hours now later. Let's just walk around, you know, it'll be good for us just to walk around. We went into Central Park, and all we could think of was, let's just walk through the park, and we walked, and there were people huddled around radios. It was a very weird sight. It almost looked like it was from, you know, the 1940s or whatever. And everybody, no one kind of spoke. Everyone had a look on their face. And we were just walking and, you know, just trying to calm people down in our group. And, again, this is hours later. And then we saw a gentleman walking towards us who was just covered in soot from head to toe. He looked like a dust cloud, you know, with a briefcase in a suit and tie. You just barely make out a suit and tie, and his face was covered. And we just stopped him and said, "What? Where am I?" And he said he was kind of like on the block or a block away when the building fell, and he got under a car, and he just got swallowed with the dust and the debris. And he just stayed there for a while till it settled, and he couldn't really see. And he just told us a story of how he wasn't in the building. He didn't work in the building. He was just, I guess he worked in an adjoining building or whatever, and he was just caught there. And he didn't know what to do. He lived in Staten Island. He obviously couldn't get over there. Everything, you know, all the crossways and the roadways were closed. And his wife was in Staten Island. And he was just walking aimlessly. He walked from downtown to 59th Street. And we happened to have an extra room. You know, we had a block of rooms for everybody, the whole contingency of the party. And there was one room that was empty. And so we just said, look, you know what? We got a room for you. You want to go and shower? And he was my size. He was my height. And I had an extra pair of jeans. I gave him a pair of jeans and a T-shirt. And he stayed with us. He stayed with us. We went out to eat that night to get something to eat. And he stayed with us. And we took in this guy who was, you know, kind of at ground zero. And the next morning, you know, that's it. He left. We parted ways. But it was something, at least. You know, my whole thing is I'm a New Yorker, and I lived there my whole life, and then I moved to L.A. for my job, and I was there. And to come in the night before this, to me, it's a odd coincidence, but it's I felt, you know, there was more to it. I was happy to be in New York when this happened. It felt like it's as if like a family member is hurt or in pain, and even if you can't do anything, you just want your presence there, just to absorb it with them. So it just felt right that I was there. And my brother was the police officer who retired about a year and a half before 9/11. So I mean, thank God he's, or who knows if he's down there. And he went down. He volunteered the next day for the cleanup. And you know, there are a couple people I knew that lost their life there. I can mention them.
Sure.
Yeah. There's a family that I grew up with, the Hoffmans, and I grew up in Forest Hills, Queens, and they had 12 kids in their family. So I was friends with a lot of them, and I was closer friends with the guy my age, and he had twin brothers, Stephen and Greg, and Stephen worked for Cantor Fitzgerald, and he lost his life. And the girl I grew up with across the street from me, she married a fireman, Bobby King, and he lost his life. So it was very, it was personal for everybody, but it just, it happened in a place that I love and where my family is. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Tom Cruise.
When the great director Billy Wilder was asked, what makes a movie unforgettable? His answer was simple. A little bit of magic. We're all here tonight or sitting at home watching because something came off a movie screen. A little bit of magic touched our lives. And you always remember where you were. The theater, the popcorn, the people you were with when it happened. It's 1968. My family was living in Ottawa, Canada. The movie was Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. I couldn't stop thinking about it. What is life? What is space? What is existence? I was 6 years old. And I knew right then and there I wanted to be an astronaut. My family traveled a lot. The white-hot thrill of Jaws, That was Louisville, Kentucky. Senior year, New Jersey. Apocalypse Now. Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. Raging Bull. I knew I wanted to be an actor. In Good Times and Four Times, movies were my lifesaver. And then last September came an event that would change us. An actor friend said to me, what are we doing? What are we doing? Is it important? Is it even important what I do? And what of a night like tonight? Should we celebrate the joy and magic that movies bring? Well, dare I say it, more than ever. A small scene, a gesture, even a glance between characters can cross lines, break through barriers, melt prejudice, just plain make us laugh. Brings us all together. That little bit of magic. That's just me. Tonight we are going to listen to you. Documentary filmmaker Errol Morris crisscrossed America asking moviegoers and culture makers a question. What do movies mean to you? And you answer. So let's expand this beautiful stage into every one of your homes, and maybe even some of you will answer this question as you stand on this stage tonight. What do movies mean to you? So pull up a sofa. It's just us talking. It's Oscar night.
Jesse, what would you have done on September the 12th, 2001? What would you have done if you'd been president?
What would I have done?
Yeah.
I would have done a legitimate investigation to find out what exactly happened on 9/11. How did they know who did this so quickly like they did Lee Harvey Oswald? How quick they knew Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy?
Because the people who did it were identified and we knew who they were.
Well, then why couldn't we have stopped them beforehand if they were identified and we knew who they were?
It was a failure of intelligence. Everyone's accepted.
No, it wasn't. We knew before with Condoleezza Rice's memo on August 6th when it stated right in the memo, Bin Laden to steal planes and run them into buildings. And more stuff is coming out now also how much the Bush administration ignored the intelligence. It was almost like they ignored it because they wanted it to happen.
Oh, come off it, Jesse.
No, not oh, come off it. Wait a minute. Every war starts with a false flag operation.
You can't, in all seriousness, sit there and try and make anybody...
let me ask you this, Pierce. Wait a minute. Let me ask you something. How much studying have you actually done of 9/11 other than what the government's told you and what mainstream media has told you? I've been studying it 4 years.
I was editor of a national newspaper.
I've talked to people
every day for 5-6 months.
Really?
So I know a lot about it.
Let me ask you this then.
You cannot say that any member of the Bush administration knew it was going to happen or wanted it to happen. It's a ridiculous thing to say.
Ridiculous. Okay, let's talk about your BBC. I have a tape of a BBC reporter in England talking about a third building has collapsed, World Trade Center Building 7, talks for 7 minutes. All the while she's talking, World Trade Center Building 7 is still standing right behind her. It didn't fall for another half hour, yet they were doing a pre-broadcast back to England
that this building fell
and it hadn't fallen yet.
If you're trying to make out the British Broadcasting Company, one of the most respected news organizations in the world, was inventing huge buildings falling over. You need to have a break, Jesse. We'll come back after the break and we'll talk about Israel and Iran.
Are you kidding me? This is a fact, my friend.
American 11, are you trying to call?
The cockpit is not answering their phone. Our number one has been stabbed, and our five has been stabbed.
I am going to call from Washington. I am in a situation where the American 11 is a possible hijack.
What's going on there? Aircraft is erratic again. Problem, are you ready? Ready, talk to me. Eddie, are you there?
What?
The 737?
Say
what?
The World Trade.
Who are you talking to?
Oh, God. Oh, my God.
Area 175, New York. We have some problems over here right now. We might have a hijack over here, two of them.
Jules, this is Ryan. Listen, on an airplane that's been hijacked. If things don't go well, it's not good news. I just want you to know, I absolutely love you. I want you to do good. So happy to find. Same to my parents and everybody. And I just totally love you, and I'll see you in the future. Bye, babe.
You're listening to another hour of the NoStopTheCast.com.
What are those people going to do? All the other areas are blocked out.
Oh, my God. So both towers are now...
Okay, now we can come on.
I got an aircraft that came out east of the White House. I just wanted to get that.
Crystal City, just north of Crystal City.
Just to the north of your town.
Yeah, stop all the parkers.
Pentagon just got hit. Don't say that. God damn, I can't protect my NCA.
United 93, that traffic through is 1 o'clock, 12 miles eastbound 370.
Negative contact, we're looking at United 93.
United 93, Cleveland, if you hear the sound of ident.
I got some business to do. The
Tuesday, 9:47 a.m.
Hi, baby. Baby, you have to listen to me carefully. I'm on a plane that's been hijacked. I'm on the plane. I'm calling from the plane. I want to tell you I love you. Please tell my children that I love them very much. And I'm so sorry, babe. I hope to be able to see your face again, baby. I love you. Bye.
456-865. We have I believe it is a Boeing 757. Can you see him up there, sir?
That's concurrent. Looks like he's rocking his wings.
Roger.
He's rocking back and forth.
We're 56865. I advise you stay away from that aircraft. Go north as fast as you can.
United 93. Have you got information on that yet?
Yeah, he's down.
He's down?
Yes.
When did he land?
He did not land.
Oh, he's down?
Yeah,
down?
Somewhere up northeast of Camp David.
Honestly, I just wanted to let you know I love you, and I'm stuck in this building in New York. There's lots of smoke, and I just wanted you to know that I love you always.
At number 2, World Trade Center, right? Nobody was seeing this in the drop. Nobody had any time, but it's getting bad. Stop! Stop!
No, stay.
I'm gonna die.
Ma'am, say your prayers.
Stop.
You gotta think positive because you gotta help each other get off the floor.
I'm gonna die.
A new type of war. That's what it is.
It may have sounded like an overstatement, but 5 years on, it's turned out to be true. The world really did change forever that day in September 2001. And not only in the most obvious ways. The war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, the so-called war on terror. In many subtle ways, all our lives have been affected. For what? The terrorists still strike. Innocent civilians still die. Osama bin Laden still free, ready to strike again at any time. No wonder Liz Hayes found bitterness and anger among the survivors of 9/11. That, and an almost overpowering sense of resilience and courage.
Something. I can still visualise what I saw that day, the explosion of the North Tower, which happened right in front of my face. The memories that I have are still strong. Probably not a day passes where I don't think about what happened that day. This is pretty much where I came out of the building, and there was stuff falling from above. The two towers were burning. There were body parts all over the road. I mean, not nice memories, but that's what we saw. That's the street that I went up and pretty much came out of the buildings here and turned around and had no idea what was going on.
Returning to Ground Zero is very difficult for James Dorney.
My friend Sue's name's up there. I reckon they'd be glad I came back. I said if I start crying, I might never stop, so I'll just make sure I don't.
On September 11th, 2001, he was a young Australian banker working on the 92nd floor of the South Tower in the World Trade Center. He was at his desk when the first plane hit the tower next door and was in a stairwell trying to get out when the second plane plowed into his building. Two 200 of his workmates perished that day.
I do realise that the odds were against me and I was faced with many choices that day, and I somehow, I'd have to say I made all the right choices, and that was very lucky, because I don't think I'd be here talking to you if I hadn't made some of those choices.
Nearly 3,000 people died that day in an area covering just a couple of city blocks. I've been to New York and seen this huge gap in the skyline many times since, but I still struggle to comprehend the enormity of it all and what it must have been like for those who were there. The people of New York are still recovering, but it's clear they're now asking a lot of questions, not the least being whether or not this could happen again.
I'm still bitter. I'm still bitter. I want some answers, and I can't find some answers.
Louis Caccioli was a fireman, and like many of the survivors of September 11, he's disillusioned.
They're not doing their job. Somebody dropped the ball here, okay? And it's time for us to wake up. We're at war, okay? This is not a game of chess. This is war we're at, okay? And it's
you're complimenting Simon Shack, and I do think September Clues is fascinating.
On the 11th day of every month, they hang out their banner on Hollywood Boulevard and hand out DVDs to passing drivers.
Question the official story.
They are members of a persistent tribe of skeptics that believes the official version of what happened a decade ago is a lie.
What we're here to do is raise awareness, to push for an unbiased and clean investigation.
There are groups of 9/11 skeptics in every major city nationwide, and they say their numbers are growing.
History has shown it's not crazy to question your government. It's crazy to not question your government.
San Francisco area architect Richard Gage has marshaled evidence he believes shows the World Trade Center towers were destroyed in a controlled demolition.
There are so many problems to this official fairy tale we're being fed.
He points to World Trade Building number 7, a 47-story tower that was not hit by an airplane, yet collapsed in 40 seconds. The official version blamed fire.
Building 7 tells us that there's a cover-up. Building 7 is the smoking gun of 9/11 that is obvious to everybody with a small amount of open-mindedness.
9/11 skeptics distribute videos like this one, as well as books and web pages, to spread their ideas. Now, there's even a comic book due to hit the shelves in early September. Called The Big Lie, it's the tale of a time-traveling scientist who goes back to 9/11 to try and stop the disaster and learns the official story is false.
Comics have always addressed serious issues. People, are, for a long time, were not willing to look at it. The implications of not believing the official story, it was just too horrible for people, that their brains just shut down.
As the new buildings rise on the site of the World Trade Center, 9/11 skeptics continue to agitate for more investigation. and to dig out evidence they believe supports their ideas.
As with other recent events in American history, from the Kennedy assassination to the Apollo moon landings, there will always be those who reject the official version of 9/11. Those who continue to believe that we are all victims of a big lie. Rob Reynolds, Al Jazeera, New York.
The beast is upon us, oh God. It's gonna get worse and worse. Oh. They love death. They come to kill. They are killing. I'm sorry. It's just the New World Order has gotta be defeated, oh God. Please, God, please protect us from the New World Order. Please protect the children, oh God. Oh God. Oh God. No. Just Stephanie, play Renegades or something. I gotta get myself together. We'll come back and get into the news. I'm sick of chronicling their evil.
And then while we're watching the first one, the second one, it looked like a plane, but I'm hearing that it wasn't. But there had to be the explosion that flew everything out, and it looked like a plane was flying by, but it's on the second one. But apparently, but that was a huge explosion. Oh, we saw the second explosion. It was flying out, and I thought I saw something go by, but maybe it was just the inside of the building coming flying out on the second building. I mean, it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. I mean, Bill Broderick. And I was going to work to park right over next to the World Trade Center with my wife, who works in the World Financial Center. We're alive. We're 10 minutes. We're lucky. And it's just, this will put the fear of the Lord in everyone, won't it? People can do this. I just have to pray to God. Not too many people are dead. This is really scary.
Bill Broderick, where are you from?
From Manhattan.
You can still talk to me. I know she's shaking.
Yes, she is.
I'm shaking as you are. I don't know.
I just tried to call my office and
the lines are all busy. The
lines are all busy. So.
Tell me, what'd you see?
It's the most extraordinary thing. It's heartbreaking. People that run out of me. It's scary. I work at the World Financial Center right across the street, and I'm just speechless. It could have been a bad building. My heart goes out.
Did you see a plane go?
I did not see a plane. They said the plane hit the first building. The second building just exploded. I just saw a big explosion. That's all I saw.
You're watching it.
I'm watching it now. I'm speechless.
Your name is Susan?
Susan. I work for a brokerage firm. And I just tried to call my office to see if everything's okay.
It's just take a while. I can't even call my office. Yeah, you may just need to stay here.
And it just terrifies that. It just breaks my heart that there's such people in the world. You know? I mean, these are people, these are human beings, and families.
Is it apparent to you that it's a terrorist act?
What could it be? I was there years ago when it happened. I was right across the street. The windows came in. I mean, I watched a lot of evacuation. I was there. So, the world trade center.
Thank you. told me that. Trying to tell me where it's at. Yes, if you love me, I can see through that. You left me hanging from the limb. You said you love me, let me love him. Lord, you give it to me, I see it in your eyes.
Trump, never one to shy away from controversial comments, isn't starting now.
The reporters are calling all day, all night. They want to find out, did Trump make a mistake?
Now, Trump is saying he watched from his Manhattan apartment as people jumped from the Twin Towers on 9/11.
I have a window in my apartment that specifically was aimed at the World Trade Center because of the beauty of the whole downtown Manhattan. And I watched as people jumped, and I watched the second plane come in.
While people were seen jumping from the towers that day, Trump's apartment in Midtown is roughly 4 miles from where the World Trade Center's towers stood.
Many people jumped, and I witnessed it. I watched that.
Trump also stubbornly defending his widely debunked claim that there were large crowds in New Jersey celebrating the day of the 9/11 attack, pointing to a line in a Washington Post story published a week later that said law enforcement had detained people allegedly seen cheering on rooftops in Jersey City.
Holding tailgate style. Tailgate. You know what that means? Tailgate. That means football games, Ohio State, thousands of people in parking lots, on roofs.
While government officials and even the reporter who wrote that story say the investigation uncovered no such celebration, Trump points to his Twitter followers as evidence to the contrary.
So all of a sudden, I'm getting all of these tweets. I saw it. I was there. I was this. But I saw it. I saw it.
The GOP frontrunner's dubious claims don't appear to be damaging him in the eyes of voters. A new Quinnipiac University poll shows Trump...
If you like this audio and want to support the site in a small or big way, please hit the PayPal donate button on the side of the Fakeologist.com webpage. You can show your support for as little as $1.19 a month by subscription or one-time donation. Thank you for your support.
In my dreams, I have a plan. But he thinks that might change if Cruz started to rise.
And Ted Cruz, Senator Cruz, has been so nice to me, I can't hit him. I may have to if he starts getting, like, really close. I may have to.
Back on the 64th floor, Pasquale had no idea what was going on, so he called home. His wife, Louise, was in bed resting. By that time, she was 7 months pregnant.
I said, Louise, I said, you know, please, I'm okay. Don't be alarmed. Don't be worried. I said, I'm perfectly fine. She's like, what's the matter? What's the matter? What happened? You know, right away, as soon as I say that, it's... I said, I'm okay. I said, just do me a favor. I said, just put the television on and just tell me what you see.
I knew that it was his building as opposed to the South Tower because his had the antenna on top. And I just said, oh, my God, Pasquale, your building is on fire.
That was a clip from the new documentary, The 9/11 Surfer, which debuts tonight on the Discovery Channel. Joining us now on set is Pasquale Bazzelli, who survived the terror attacks 11 years ago today. He and his wife, Louise, also here with us, have written the book, We All Fall Down. Still looking for a publisher. I understand it's an incredible story. I'm sure somebody's going to pick it up after they hear this. It's so great to have you both here with us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Pasquale, set the stage a little bit. You were engineer for the Port Authority. Walk us through the early stages of that morning. For you?
Went through my normal routine, getting up in the morning. My wife was still sleeping, very, very pregnant at the time. I remember the night before I was watching Monday Night Football, and I got up maybe a little bit later than I should have. So I ended up getting into work a little later. And because of that, I was actually in the elevator going to the 64th floor, the express elevator, and that's when I first felt the impact from the first plane hit the North Tower. So I was actually in the elevator at the time.
And a lot of people will ask, and I know Louise was asking you that day, why did you stay in the building so long? I think it was 80 minutes after impact before you decided it was time to go down. Why did you stay?
Right. Everyone asked me that question. It's a lot of factors. Once I finally reached the floor, everyone who decided to evacuate had evacuated already. So it was myself and the gentleman in the elevator, Bill, who joined 14 others on the floor, and there were 16 of us total. They had decided to stay. My boss at the time had called down to the security desk, and he was told to stay and wait till help arrives. There was thought that let's keep the stairway clear, because I was also in the 93 bombing, and I had to evacuate at that time, and they correct a lot of deficiencies, but the stairs at that time acted like chimneys, so they were filled with smoke. So some people were hesitant leaving until they knew it was clear or safe to go down. Some people wanted to keep the stairs clear so that firemen could actually reach the point of impact and also allow others that were injured to get by. So by staying out of the stairs, we thought it was the best thing to do until we were told to go. And honestly, not knowing that the building would ever collapse, there was no reason to I guess, rush or be scared at that point. It was a well-lit, functioning office.
Is this when you called your wife? Where were you when you made the call to your wife?
As soon as I reached the floor and I spoke to my my boss, Pat, I said, Pat, what happened? And he said, I don't know, but he goes, I was knocked out of my chair. I said, let me call my wife. She's at home. I don't want her seeing this. I knew, the television, the media, reports things right away. So right. I said, she's going to know before I know what happened to
the building. And you did. You saw the antenna on the top of the tower. You call him up. Did you say, get the hell out of there?
He basically called me and woke me up, and he said, Louise, if you turn on the TV, let me know if you see anything. And I did, and excuse me, I said, Pasquale, your building is on fire. The top of your building is on fire. And as I sat and listened a little bit longer, I heard the newscaster say, we think a plane hit the World Trade Center. And I said, they're saying they think a plane hit. So he wanted to know where, in regards to the building, was it hit? Was it like high, low, or you know?
Middle,
so
yeah.
We figured that he was a little bit, he was below it, thank God.
And I was just going to ask you, when the tower eventually falls, we were just talking about this, I had the same experience with my sister-in-law. You're sitting thinking, you've just watched on television your husband, the father of your unborn child, die on TV. What's the feeling like, and what happens for that, for you after that?
That feeling was, total helplessness. Just total, I wanted to jump through the television screen. I just kept screaming, no, no, no. And I felt like everything in my body just like drained out. And when it finally fell, I couldn't even watch anymore because I had watched the second plane hit and then Tower 2 come down. And then I was trying to say, don't think it. It's not going to happen. And it did happen. And it was just, I basically lost my life at that point.
But little did you know, a miracle had just taken place. Pasquale, if you can recount what happened as you're going down the stairs and everything gives way.
Eventually, when we decided to leave, it was after the South Tower had collapsed. And I think it was a good thing, but I didn't know the South Tower had collapsed because where our office was located is on the northwest corner. And the way the building was set up, you couldn't see the South Tower from that angle. It was blocked. So we felt this rumbling. and we attributed it to maybe part of the building, the plane or something collapsing up above. And that's when we decided to gather our things and start getting ready to head down. The smoke started filling in on the floor. We entered, I believe it was stairway B, and we started making our descent down the stairs. We had reached probably in the 40s and encountered firemen sitting there, I mean, just exhausted, taking a break. They had all their gear on, you know, drenched with sweat. I remember, you know, stepping over them and between them to try to get by, and they said, just keep going. It's a clear run. Just keep going. We encountered some more firemen in the 30s. One of them said, you can get off in an elevator on the 24th floor. And we all just were resounding, everyone right away, no, you know, we're not getting into an elevator at this point. And as I was going down the stairs, I remember passing and looking, 26, 25, 25, so 24, this is where we could get off, but we're not. And it was only a couple of flights later when all of a sudden I heard this tremendous loud freight train type of noise from above. The railing, the stairs started shaking violently in that split second. I didn't know. I thought something was falling through the stairs. And just in order to protect myself as much as possible, I just dove onto the next landing. I buried myself in the corner, laid on the floor next to the wall, trying to protect myself from anything. Maybe it was falling. I had nowhere to run. Curled up in a fetal position, and I just prayed at that point and as I was praying, the wall cracked and the floor gave way. And that's when I started to free fall, and I realized at that point, oh my God, this is how I'm going to die. This is it. You know, he was wondering how you're going to die. And first thought, oh my God, I'm going to die. This is it. Please protect my wife, my unborn child, Hope. I prayed for a quick death. And I stayed tucked in to a fetal position. I felt this sandblaster, abrasive kind of air. I was getting hit, impacts. I saw flashes of light from the impacts. You know, if you ever get hit with a baseball or you know something, or you know, a punch or something, you see that flash of falling. I saw several flashes of light and then one bright flash. And a split second later, I opened up my eyes. And I was just sitting there, totally numb, looking up at blue sky. Then it got dark. From the smoke and everything, and I started to cough. I started to feel pain in my leg, and I said, I couldn't even believe at that point that I was alive, and I survived that, and there was nothing above me.
Do you have any sense for how you fell from the 22nd floor, which is the way you've identified it? Mm-hmm. You landed on a rubble that most people think was about 7 stories high.
Right.
So we're talking about a 15-story free fall on theoretically a piece of concrete. That's why they call you the 9/11 surfer. There are people in this documentary, as the viewers will see tonight, MIT physicists who explain perhaps what might have happened, a hurricane force wind that almost lifted you up and allowed you to float down. Do you remember at all what it felt like? Do you have any idea of how you might have survived that fall?
I remember everything. I remember the fall. I mean, every moment of that fall, I remember. so I, you know, I experienced it, and I think it's how I've been describing it that I guess the experts were able to come up with that theory. I was wondering myself, you know. So I guess it makes sense.
We'll obviously see the full story through your voice on Discovery, but him coming home after all of this, how do you describe that moment, seeing him again?
Well, when I first got the phone call from him, you see, you can understand that our house was filled with people by 3:30 that afternoon, and I never spoke to him again. And when he called and I answered the phone, and he said, "Louise, it's me," and I was like, "Pasquale, Pasquale, oh my God, it's Pasquale!" And the whole house just was like an uproar and screaming, and you know, I knew that if I heard his voice, that even if he was missing an arm or a leg, that he was alive. And when he finally did come home that night, it was a long day, and just being there, waiting in the driveway, you know, people were still over the house, and I couldn't wait to touch him and feel him, and you know, make sure it was really you, and that you were really home. And I mean, it was a nightmare that turned into, for us anyway, you know, it ended. Him coming home. What we dealt with after that is another story.
Hard.
Yeah.
And Pasquale, you tell your story now Why did you wait so long?
I feel like I can tell the story now. I did tell the story then on, you know, small local type things, and everybody said, you have to tell your story, you have to tell your story, it's amazing. It was difficult telling the story then, you know, it's just the emotions, and they still are, but they were much raw, you know, very raw then. And now I'm able to deal with it, I'm able to, you know, be happy again, and, you know, and feel the joy of life again, so I'm able to tell it.
And your beautiful daughters, Hope and Mia, are both here with you today. We're glad you're here with them, Pasquale. Thank you so much for telling your story. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The documentary is The 9/11 Surfer. It premieres tonight at 8 o'clock Eastern on the Discovery Channel. And their book, co-authored by Louise, We All Fall Down. Pasquale and Louise, thank you. We'll be right back.
Tom Hanks and Sandra Bullock star in Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close as the parents of a young boy who goes on a search after his father dies on 9/11. I just spoke with Hanks about his role as a victim of the terrorist attacks. And did you spend any time with 9/11 victims' families at all, or how did you prepare?
No, we didn't. There was such a plethora of things, because quite frankly, we didn't know that it was going to be 9/11. That was the thing we had to constantly remind ourselves of. When I was working, I said, look, let's not take this too seriously, because it's just September 9th. We don't know what's going on. But we, you know, there's no way you can escape the power, the seriousness of the day. And we did go down, we talked to the unofficial, you know, Victims Museum, the Survivors Museum, and there's a lot of an unending parade of stuff that you can read and see about the day. And going back and looking at that is an extremely palpable reminder of really what happened.
The boy is played by newcomer Thomas Horn, whose only previous on-camera credit was as the winner of Jeopardy! Kids Week back in 2010.
He's an extraordinary guy. You know, I don't know if we can have an opinion of him as an actor, because he's not. But yet he is this kind of like presence in a movie that is kind of like a non-actory presence. We never really talked about, I think, lines or say this line or do that or hit that mark. We were talking about trying to capture a moment of behavior between father and son. That's what it required, but that's what we were doing. And you can't really fake that.
Young Thomas Horn, the way he carried this movie, he carries an entire film, and it's extraordinary. I mean, you know, you feel like a proud parent. Basically, Tom and I, a little older Tom and I, are the proud parents of this extraordinary experience.
This has probably got to be one of your first red carpets. How excited are you tonight?
Well, I mean, it is exciting. You're right about that. It's my second red carpet ever. It's very stimulating experience, lots of lights and people screaming, but it's interesting.
You can see Horn's performance alongside veteran co-stars Hanks and Bullock when Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close opens in theaters on Christmas Day in limited release, followed by a wide release on January 20th. Ken Lombardi, CBSNews.com, New York.
It was a day of unimaginable horror, a level of destruction few Americans could ever have imagined. But of all the shocking images, it was this frozen moment which has come to symbolize the human cost of 9/11. Beneath the dust was Marcy Borders. She had run from her office in the North Tower, trying to find safety.
Every time I inhaled, my mouth just filled up with it. I was choking. I couldn't see my hand in front of my face. I was just like, you know, saying to myself and saying out loud that I didn't want to die. I didn't want to die.
Marcy survived, but the effect of that day reverberated through her life like it did for so many. Gripped by depression, she descended into alcoholism and drug abuse, losing custody of her children. But 4 years ago, she went into rehab and turned her life around. Then, like many people caught at ground zero, Marcy was diagnosed with cancer. She blamed the particles she breathed in on September the 11th. Hers was far from the only personal image from the Twin Towers attack, but the moment of despair meant it was printed in newspapers around the world.
It's the look, the element of shock, and it is purely, it is personalized, something that was so vast, people are still having trouble dealing with it. That photograph takes you back to a time, a point in time that will remain locked in time forever.
It is the legacy Marcy Borders eventually came to accept. Today her daughter said, not only is she the Dust Lady, but she is my hero. Duncan Golestani, ITV News.
Police have a suspect in custody in connection with the vandalism of a 9/11 memorial last week. The suspect is currently in custody on an unrelated charge. Police have not released that person's identity. The monument sits on Geneva's waterfront and has been there for more than a decade.
From the destruction of the Twin Towers, a story of survival emerged.
I know of stories, miraculous stories, that people rode the building down.
Of a man who fell with the towers and rose from the rubble.
He was still standing on that slab and we managed to get him out of there.
It was dismissed as an urban myth.
Virtually everything that was in the towers was torn into smaller pieces.
Now, for the first time, the true extraordinary story is told.
That feeling of just riding the air, that's what I felt.
You're talking the wings of angels here.
9/11, The Miracle Survivor, Monday at 10 on 4.
Local reaction continues now as Americans reflect on the death of perhaps this country's biggest enemy. People who personally faced bin Laden's terror are starting a new chapter.
News Channel 5's Evan Axelbank joined us now. And Evan, you spoke to a man from Royal Palm Beach who was in the World Trade Center when it was hit September 11th. Good morning.
Morning. The man I spoke with didn't even know that bin Laden had been killed until we called him at about midnight. He says that while nothing can ever heal all the wounds that bin Laden created, this is a good start.
Justin Gerard was a bright-eyed 22-year-old, beginning his career in the financial industry with Morgan Stanley. It was the second day of a three-week company orientation.
Going to lunch with a buddy of mine on the plaza, and we're looking up and just looking at the majesty of these buildings.
That was September 10th. The next day, an hour after he took his seat on the 60th floor of the South Tower, the North Tower was hit. As he and dozens of others sat in a staircase deciding on whether to evacuate, the building that he was in was hit.
And the building shook like it was made of rubber. Your mind kind of slows all that stuff down. It probably only lasted 3 or 4 seconds, but it felt like it shook for a considerable period of time. It actually felt like the building was falling. Couldn't get your bearings straight.
Since then, he has spoken to area schools about his surviving the attack that killed 2,606 who were in those majestic buildings. He has also wondered, especially on the anniversaries of September 11th, whether Osama bin Laden would ever pay.
In my mind, he was responsible.
The bill has come due. Gerard was glued to the TV.
I don't think the wounds will ever fully be closed, but certainly this brings closure to the situation. It certainly brings closure in some way to 9/11.
He's struck by the time that it took, not just that officials had their eye on bin Laden's compound since August, but that Americans have been trying to kill bin Laden since the day that bin Laden's followers nearly killed him.
10 years, it took so long. It's just unbelievable that as large and as powerful as we are, that it took that long to bring him to justice.
Here is one example of the terror that Osama bin Laden created. Justin's wife knew that he was in the World Trade Center that morning and was unable to reach him until after both towers had crashed to the ground. Gerard says that when he was finally able to get through on the phone, the phone call was the most emotional moment that he has ever had. John Roxanne, back to you.
Think about all the office equipment and computers and chairs and desks that were in that building. We didn't find, like, chairs and desks, and it was just dust.
Patrick was just 18 when the towers fell.
He had told me he was going down there, and I told him I didn't think it was a good idea.
Disappointed by a rejection letter he received from West Point, Ground Zero, he felt, was where he could make a difference.
Patrick said to me, if I don't do this, I will regret it the rest of my life.
Whenever we were working, like, we never talked about it. You're just doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do, and that's it, you know.
Around that corner? Yes. There's nothing open around that corner, yes, that I know of.
Anytime we recovered somebody, we knew that that family was going to have something to bury.
He was also searching for closure for his own family. He was searching for his father.
I wanted to be there if we did find my father.
One stock that could come under pressure is Boeing.
Kevin Dowdell was a family man and decorated New York City fireman.
I never worried about him as a kid. He was just going to work.
I always gave a kiss goodbye and said I love you.
Rose Ellen was teaching in the city that morning.
And I thought to myself, wow, what a perfectly beautiful day.
This just in, you were looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is
just a few moments.
I called my mother in the afternoon. She said, oh, I haven't heard from daddy yet.
One person had a cell phone that was working.
Oh my goodness.
My right now, terrorist.
And I used her phone to call the firehouse. I asked if Kevin was there, and they said no. This is he at the Trade Center, and he said yes.
Start relocating companies into the area.
A friend of ours said that, you know, he saw them line up on West Street, give them orders on what they were going to do, and then go into the South Tower. Good Lord. There are no
the
words.
Tower is gone.
World Trade Towers that they
have collapsed.
Anytime something bad would happen and he knew it would be on the news and he was there, he would call right away.
And then I'm watching the reports and they were saying that they estimated about 500 firemen were killed. And then I really just got a really sick feeling in my stomach and I just knew. I knew something happened.
And we're just about 6 blocks away from what's being called Ground Zero.
After a couple of days and we hadn't heard from them,
kind of said to them, you know, not giving up hope, but there's a really good chance that Daddy's not coming home.
This is what's left of the carefully organized files.
My mother, father, brother, we did everything together. We just kind of were like not sure how to feel.
It was really difficult, especially at the beginning.
Anytime the door would open, you know, you kind of look and see maybe he's coming in the door.
It's like 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm out there. I'm like expecting to walk from the parking lot because I'm like, this can't be, you know, that he left. And I mean, you know, his shoes were by the door, and his jacket was on the back of the chair, and, you know, his stuff was on the counter, and, you know, it was just hard.
The body of Kevin Dowdell was never recovered. But they did find closure.
So this is the officer's halligan that they found at Ground Zero.
They kind of passed it along from fireman to fireman until it got to me.
Knew it was his. There was a KD for Kevin Dowdell, and then an R4 for Rescue Company 4. But this was found about a block away. So you can imagine the force of the building falling.
I always think that it was his way of saying, here you go.
It's all we have. So it was the last thing he was holding that day.
That was basically all we have.
This is what we have left, too. Normally you could see Manhattan from here.
Patrick went on to reapply to West Point, a dream he and his father shared. And this time, he was accepted. He deployed twice in defense of his country. Patrick's younger brother, James, followed in his father's footsteps.
He raised us to know what to do now.
I'm happy that my sons are successful.
I would tell my soldiers and guys when it would come up, you are there to fight for families like mine. I always miss being able to come to New York.
And I think other people say, oh yeah, now it's 10 years. But for us,
It's a nice place to come.
It's every day.
The images are with us forever.
And all week we've been looking back at 9/11 and how it impacts Hampton Roads. No one from our area had more of a front row seat to this tragedy than Virginia Task Force 2 from Virginia Beach. And Andy Fox met with one of those task force members who to this day is still moved to tears by what he saw.
Tom and Stephanie moved to tears by images. Images Jim Ingledew cannot escape. As hard as he tries, he always remembers what he found at the Pentagon.
I actually had the TV on in time to see the second tower hit.
That first image and Jim Ingledew witnessed 9/11. It never leaves this member of Virginia Task Force 2 who was sent to the Pentagon on 9/11 as part of FEMA. Ingledew led the search component of Task Force 2. He remembers this image arriving at the Pentagon.
I was like, man, it looks like a movie set or something, you know. It can't be real.
Ingledew cannot, will not forget American Airlines Flight 77 passenger Suzanne Calley. He found her driver's license in the wreckage of the terrorist crashed plane.
I remember thinking, this driver's license. It's like she just picked it up from DMV. Now a scratch on it amongst all this.
As he collected personal items from the Pentagon ruins, Callie's license moved him.
We had like a bucket that we were putting stuff in. I just kind of held on to that, and when we took the stuff to the FBI, I sort of handed it to him instead of throwing it in the bucket.
An image of despair, dark and deep.
I don't know why I did it. I just picked that license up. I just felt for her, you know, and her family, because we all said, yeah, she didn't deserve it.
No one deserved it, yet in the ashes of what evil wrought, an image generated by Task Force 2 here in this video at work, shoring up the Pentagon.
The symbolism of the Pentagon as America, and we were building shores to make sure, right, that's what that cribbing stuff is called, shores, and it's to make sure that the building doesn't fall down anymore.
Shoring up America, that America will stabilize, rebuild, fight back. But it was back home at Christmas time that gave Ingledew the most powerful image of all, Norfolk's grand illumination on tall buildings.
And I remember telling my 2-year-old daughter, sitting in a car seat in the back seat, I said, wow, look at the lights, aren't they pretty? Look at the big buildings. And she said, yeah, Daddy, maybe a plane won't fly into it. And I thought, what a shame that that's how she has to think about it.
Think about it. 9/11. Can't forget it. Won't forget it. Everything changed the day the planes flown by evil crashed. Now, what happened on 9/11 made Ingledew mad. Mad about the tragedy for all the victims. Mad the terrorist even got to his 2-year-old daughter. Ingledew's flashbacks are as vivid today as they were 10 years ago. I'm Andy Fox, 10 on your side.
To my right was stairway C, ahead of me was stairway B, and to my left was stairway A. For whatever reason, it was almost like I got a push on the right shoulder. I went around to the left to stairway A and started down. And I will tell you that nobody has come up with any story of anybody going down stairway C or B like the story I'm about to tell you going down stairway A. I was face-to-face with a fellow named Bobby Call, C-O-L-L. Bobby and I were just, I said, you know, what are you doing over here? Because I knew where his desk was. And he just said, well, I've been down a few stairs. I heard the announcement. I came back up. And he was in the middle of that sentence when boom, boom, that double explosion again, and our room just got rocked, just destroyed in a second. And it was for the next 10 seconds after that immediate impact that was the only 10 seconds of the day that I was afraid, terrified, in fact. A banging noise inside the 81st floor, and I strained to listen to what I thought was a voice, and indeed, I finally made out a stranger's voice, sort of muffled, but screaming at the same time, help, help, I'm buried, is anybody there? I can't breathe. Down by the floor, I saw this hand waving up and down, and the person was saying, can you see my hand? Can you see my hand? And when I finally got the light on his hand and shone it down to these eyes that were kind of in a hole in a wall, he was reaching through, waving. And he said, hallelujah, I've been saved. I heaved him up over the wall, and we sort of fell backwards, him on top of me, me on my back. And he gave me a big kiss, and I said, I'm Brian. And he said, well, I'm Stanley. He said, we'll be brothers for life. And I said, well, I don't have any brothers. I don't have any siblings. I said, we'll be brothers for life. Back to the stairs. Down, 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 Stanley and I went. On the 15th floor, I said to him, hey, slow down, man. You know, I don't want to be coming in on crutches tomorrow, thinking, you know, that we'd be back at our office sort of cleaning up the mess. So we slowed down a bit, got to the plaza level. We looked out into the middle courtyard where the fountain was and so on, and saw this gray, ashen area, normally full of people and flowers and vendors' carts and so on, just an abandoned site. stared at it for 30 seconds rather in disbelief, and then down an escalator behind us. When we got to the doors underneath the would be 4 World Trade Center, the fireman said, "Hey guys, if you're going to run across Liberty Street here, you've got to go for it." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, there's debris falling from above." I said, "Should I look up?" He said, "No, just go for it." And Stanley turned more than 90 degrees around, and he looked back at the South Tower that we just come out of, and he said, "You know, I think that building could come down right there." And I said, "There's no way. That's a steel structure. That, you know, that's just draperies and carpets and so on." And I didn't really finish that sentence. And right up at the top, like we were invited to watch, boom, 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 down it started to come. And you know, 8 or 10 seconds later, we all know that the tower collapsed. And it was mystifying. It was surreal. It was impossible. It was a whole bunch of things. It's like this hole in the sky, you know, somewhere I'd worked for 27 years since 1974 was gone. It just made no sense at all. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of unanswerable questions. You know, why me? Why not somebody else? Why them? And all of those things. And I have been given a gift. Again, I take no credit for it. I'm just fortunate that I don't have survivor guilt. I don't waste energy on trying to answer those unanswerable questions. And that may sound cold to some people. I can't help that, and I don't want it to sound cold. I'm just being truthful, telling you that's where I am. That's my experience. And so I will say, yes, I feel very fortunate that that's my end result. I'm surprised that it's 10 years. If you're given a certain amount of time on this planet, 10 years is a big chunk of that time, and it hasn't seemed to take long for 10 years to pass.
Finally tonight, Ray Suarez spent the day at a hospital near the World Trade Center in New York. Here's his report.
When the first plane slammed into the World Trade Center last Tuesday, there were scores of wounded on the street. Before anyone knew there was another plane coming, before it was understood this was a terror attack, all eyes had turned to a small hospital near Manhattan's southern tip.
Most people don't think of this part of New York as a residential area, but because of the financial district, it has a daytime population of 400,000 people. That's about the same size as Miami or in Atlanta. So when the World Trade Center started to burn, they came to the closest place they could. The injured were brought here, to the NYU downtown hospital.
Leonard Aubrey is the hospital's CEO.
Timing is everything in life, and on July 31st, we had a disaster drill, which we do a couple of times a year, of sort of checking on our disaster plan, see if everything goes in place, making sure the right people are at the right place at the right time. So we conducted that drill on July 31st very successfully. We were also fortunate enough to have several of our vendors and suppliers just show up because they wanted to help out. Just show up. Our partner institution, NYU Medical Center, sent supplies down here, just sent supplies without being asked, just showing up. And that really brought us through the real difficult parts, early stages of this attack.
Dr. Howard Beaton is the chief of surgery.
Some patients were very, very severely injured, and 3 patients were actually brought in dead on arrival. Some of the more severe injured patients were patients who had severe head injuries. There were several of those. Patients who had severe injuries to their chest, bleeding inside their chest, spinal cord fractures. We took care of many spinal cord fractures, fractures of the pelvis, bleeding internally, large soft tissue injuries with big burns and large amounts of tissue loss, muscle hanging out, limbs at all sorts of strange angles. It was really quite something to see. And for somebody who has not had any wartime experience, this is, I suspect, as close to a battlefield as you'll ever get. And quite frankly, for a while we felt like we were really a MASH unit.
Being so close to the attack site was beneficial. Being so close was terrible. The hospital lost its power and had to be supplied by generators. Security cordons made it hard for staff to reach the hospital.
We made the decision to stabilize these people and transfer them out to our affiliate hospitals uptown by ambulance. And we wanted to do that throughout the day so that we would keep vacant beds in the hospital at all times in the expectation that we would receive the sort of second wave of patients coming from the tragedy.
We were then in a situation where we were told to expect the second wave. And at one time we were told that that second wave might be as many as 500 acutely ill patients brought here. So we then restocked, we restaffed, we made sure that everything was ready and available for them. And then we just waited. And the problem with the wait is you never know when it's going to end. So it became Tuesday afternoon, it became Tuesday evening, it became Wednesday morning. We were fully staffed, and the realization that there were no more severely ill patients coming from the disaster site is something that really, I think, just sunk in over the day on Wednesday and became a reality on Thursday.
No survivors have been pulled from the site for days. Not one. So now the hospital is treating its remaining initial victims, waiting for power and supplies, and treating injured and exhausted rescue workers like Jim Ciotti.
Are you going to go back in after you take it easy for a little while, or is this it for you?
No, I'm going back over. Got to.
Why do you have to?
Because I feel I have to. Wouldn't be right not to. Everybody else is working so hard. So it's my obligation to do that, too.
A place like NYU downtown runs in a disaster because of people like Deborah Sonnenblick, who broke a foot at the attack site and kept on working anyway, and the staff members who rushed food, aid, and drugs to the senior citizens' residence it serves, now days without electricity, hot water, and open pharmacies.
We're still trying to find out about mail deliveries. We're still trying to find out exactly what public transportation is open.
The staff wants to start normal life Monday, when the flood of the hopeful searching for missing friends and relatives slows to a trickle. The hard work of reconnecting Lower Manhattan to the rest of New York is continuing at a furious pace, washing down debris-covered buildings, struggling to restore electricity, power, phones, vacuuming up the thick dust that blankets this neighborhood for blocks, and readying the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange for the reopening of the U.S.-based markets Monday morning, even as the dangerous struggle to find the injured and the dead continues round the clock just a few blocks away.
San Francisco-bound United Airlines Flight 93 took off from Newark Airport on September 11th, just as it did every morning. 46 minutes into the flight, it was hijacked.
Flight 93 was in air when the other three planes had crashed, and it became quite apparent to everybody on board what the fate of the plane was.
One of those people was senior flight attendant Lorraine Bay.
Lorraine Bay and I have been friends since 1972. Lorraine and I always flew together. And over the course of the year, she got closer and closer.
You're listening to another hour of Thinkologist Audio Chat on Thinkologist.com.
Those idiots don't even know where
and
we live.
One of those telephone exchanges, they said they decided to form a resistance in just a matter of minutes, and actually did try to get into the cockpit and alter the plans of the hijackers.
After a struggle in the cockpit, the plane crashed into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The plane was destroyed, and everyone on board was killed. Few intact objects were found. One of them was Lorraine Bay's flight manual, donated by her husband Eric and delivered by friend and fellow flight attendant Kathy Stanchek.
It was in a brown cardboard box, and I'm saying, do I want to open it now? Do I not? And when I opened it, it just reeked of jet fuel. And I broke down then. I said, now it's reality now. It's kind of like I'm holding history in my hand.
Oh,
people say we don't need this war, but I say there's some things worth fighting for. What about our freedom and this piece of ground? We didn't get to keep them by backing down. They say we don't realize the mess we're getting in. Before you start your preaching, let me ask you this, my friend. Have you forgotten how it felt that day? Took all the footage off my TV. Said it's too disturbing for you and me. It'll just breed anger, that's what the experts say. If it was up to me, I'd show it every day. Some say this country is just out looking for a fight. After 9/11, man, I'd have to say that's right. Have you forgotten how it felt that day? See your homeland under fire and her people blown away. Have you forgotten when those towers fell? We had neighbors still inside going through a living hell.
Nobody died. Nobody got hurt.
That's all, folks.